Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Are you bleary-eyed from poring over the shocking results from Super Tuesday?
I am not. I got a pretty good night's sleep last night, partly because, you know, Virginia, the state I lived in for many years, reported that Donald Trump won the state about 3 minutes after 7 p.m., I think, after the election closed there. That, to me, Virginia was a big test. If Nikki Haley could have won there, that would have been something. She ended up, I think, only winning Vermont. So no need for me to stay up late, especially since, Bill, I will be staying up late to watch the State of the Union.
But she won 35% in Virginia, which I still would. I mean, I was not going into this thinking she was going to win Virginia. I mean, it's very clear that she was winning in moderate, suburban, highly educated type areas, which is not nearly enough to win almost every state. But to get to 35% is sort of, you know, a respectable number for someone who was a obvious loser, who is not going to be the nominee. And she won, you know, a handful of cities in the Northern Virginia, D.C. suburbs and college town areas.
Yeah, like Charlottesville and Falls Church, Virginia, Northern Virginia stuff. Look, though, in Virginia, there is no registration. Anyone, unless they've chosen to participate in the other party's convention or primary, is eligible. You could just go vote. You're not, there's no voter registration. So, like, for example, I voted for Joe Biden against Bernie Sanders 4 years ago in Virginia, having never registered as a Democrat or voted Democrat in my life. So, and again, I mean, the population of Northern Virginia is immense. You would have thought maybe she could have done even better. So I don't think it was a great night for Nikki Haley. And Donald Trump is now very close to a point where he mathematically has enough delegates to be the nominee. And as we're taping this, Bill, Nikki is poised to give a speech where I think she's going to drop out.
Right. So we're taping a little before 10 a.m. on Wednesday. I think she's supposed to talk at 10. All the telegraphing is she's dropping out. She's suspending her campaign, so technically not ending it, and is saying she not endorse Trump, but is going to say that Trump needs to earn the votes of her supporters, which, if this was any other race, and perhaps we should be talking about for this race, you would say this is an obvious play for VP. You need my voters to unify this party. I am getting 15, 25, 35% of the vote, you know, and this party has to unify. You need a coalition ticket. You need me to bring this coalition back together. That's the obvious subtext. People might not be jumping to that as readily now because people might think there's no way in hell Donald Trump's going to pick Nikki Haley, which I kind of agree with. But I think Nikki Haley might be suffering a degree of delusion and thinking that she has cards to play here to force him to make that decision.
Yes. Let me play. So I agree. I don't think Trump would ever select Nikki Haley as his running mate. But I do think it's possible that Nikki Haley's voters, 30, 40%, some of these people are Democrats. They're going to vote for Biden anyway. Some of them are going to stay home. Some of them may vote for Trump, but will enough of them stay home? I think that's the question. What percentage of Nikki Haley Republicans could doom Trump? I'm going to play this clip if I can get my technology to work, Bill, and have you comment on the other side. This is Karl Rove on Fox News making the point.
Ought to be concerned about unifying the Republican Party because, as we see in the in these states, a third of the vote in Virginia, 43% of the vote in Massachusetts going to Nikki Haley, a quarter of the vote in North Carolina. Maine has now dropped down to about a quarter of the vote, but it was 31% for Nikki Haley. Vermont, 48%. There's still some work to be done to unify the Republican Party, and that's going to depend a lot on his tone tonight and whether or not he stops doing things like calling her bird brain.
Bird brain. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't think it's just stylistic. I mean, it's hard. I don't want to go farther. Sorry. Dog sees other dog. Nova, shush. We can't know from the primary results how many Republican voters, Trump 2020 voters, are now fully anti-Trump voters or on the fence because they love Nikki Haley so much. And we can't know how many of these uncommitted voters in the Democratic primary are Biden 2020 voters. Nova, stop. We can't know how many Biden uncommitted voters are Biden 2020 voters who are fully off the team or are demanding Biden change course in the Middle East to get their votes. But my gut feeling is that the divide on the Republican side runs deeper than the divide on the Democratic side. And in particular, I think there is a chunk of the Republican Party that does not want to be cozy with Russia. They want to support Ukraine. It's not just about the particular, not just that one issue, but the broader sense of what does this party stand for? Does it stand for a robust promotion of democracy abroad, or does it stand with this America first? We don't care what other countries do in terms of democracy. Let's just be transactional with Putin and Saudi Arabia, North Korea, and the like. On the Democratic side, yeah, there's significant division between people who lean Israel, people who lean Palestine. But I think almost every Democrat would say, we want the violence to end and to get on the path to a two-state solution. So there's an end goal that's much more widely shared on the Democratic side that I think is the case on the Republican side, which makes it very hard for Haley voters, I think, to be fully persuaded. Some of them, at least.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if Haley ultimately endorses Trump. I hope she doesn't, but we'll see. But Bill, since you've invoked the Democrats, I do have to ask you, it's been a few days now, but there was a New York Times Siena poll, I believe, a few days ago that showed Biden losing to Trump. Seems like there have been a lot of polls, some within the margin of error, but you got to be a little bit worried. The hope is always like once consumer confidence ticks up, once it's a binary choice, you know, once something happens, then Biden will go ahead in the polls, but it hasn't happened yet. And I'm wondering if it will.
Well, you know, there's more choices available for Democratic psyches between total nonchalant sanguine and utter hair on fire panic. One poll showing Biden down 5 in February or taken in February, released in March, doesn't mean that that's the end of days. People have gained 5 points in an 8-month span before. But also keep in mind, there have been 8 other polls taken in this same period, starting in the last week of February. The New York Times poll is the worst of all of them for Biden. The rest of them range from Trump up 4 to Biden up 1. And the average of it is about Trump plus two. I understand the consternation. How could Trump be up 2 when he's literally on trial for 91 felony counts and the economy is actually in good shape? This doesn't compute. What is it? It must be Biden's age and image is so awful that these other fundamental metrics aren't carrying him the way they should. Like, I get that conclusion. But it is also the case that it can take time for people to feel these economic improvements and credit the president for them. And Trump has been pretty furiously revising the narrative of the of life under his watch. And you may think, how can anyone forget? How can anyone forget what life was like back then? But, you know, people's memories are short. You know, he is more robustly making the case of life was awesome under me. And you haven't seen the Democrats do something parallel to say, remember what things were really like? Remember how awful things were? Remember how our cities were literally burning after 4 years of the hate he was spewing and turning us against each other? So there's cards to play the Democrats haven't played yet. And perhaps now that it's really settled who these nominees are going to be, and Biden's going to kick off the State of the Union address, you know, tomorrow, that game is going to really be afoot now.
Well, you mentioned the State of the Union address. What are you looking for? And I mean, can Biden? My take is that it's more important that he looks and sounds energetic than that he says anything specifically. But what do you think?
I mean, I think both things matter here. The performance has to be solid. He can't lose his place. He shouldn't fumble a name. Hopefully, not that I think that's the end of the world, but it'd be a lot better if it was just like a clean, error-free, solid speech. But you know, the one number in the New York Times poll, I wrote about this in the Washington Monthly newsletter, that really jumped out at me. I mean, the Times headline really pushed the age question. They had a secondary story, you know, 70-80% think Biden's too old to run. Okay. After like weeks and weeks and weeks of this being obsessively harped on the media, guess what? It gets spat back from voters in polls. Surprise, surprise. That still doesn't tell me that is going to be a determining factor come election day 8 months from now. You can't discern that from a poll in February. And we have no evidence of that being historically true when age has been come up in campaigns, if it's been a determining factor. We do have much stronger correlation between economic performance and incumbent reelections. And in the Times poll, 51% say the economy is poor. Now, that's just demonstrably not true. Like it's just not the case. We have new record low unemployment. We have a new record low narrow gap between racial disparity in unemployment. We have wages beating inflation. We have real disposable income going up. Everything is going in the right direction here. So people's perception is just way out of line with the reality. And that can be fixed. That's something you can do something about. You can connect the dots in a very robust way, not just in one speech, but as part of a broader campaign. You know, I wrote about how Biden should emulate the Morning in America ad a few weeks ago. And I said in that, well, I did acknowledge that, you know, the Morning in America ad came in September. And, you know, Reagan was already beating Mondale at that point. So it wasn't that heavy a lift. But he did still, you know, things weren't super great economic. I mean, interest rates were much higher than they are right now, like double or triple, if I remember. I think at least double. And the Reagan ad was, it's so easy to buy a home now. I mean, they were making an argument that kind of stretched the bounds of what was really true. I mean, the economy was better in many respects because inflation was down, but interest rates actually weren't all that better compared to Carter. They got even worse in the 82 recession. They were better from that point. So they really had to make a aggressive case, you know, like, hey, if you're young and you're getting married, like it's really easy to get your life going now. In the case of Biden, you know, so the point I wanted to make there was, I mentioned that the ad didn't come until September. And I actually uncovered just a few days ago, there was a Reagan ad in the spring of 1984 making the economic case. That just wasn't quite as creative as the one we know about, but it was a similar theme and tone and language. So they actually recognized early on, we need to aggressively make a positive case about the economy. We can't just assume everyone's going to just come to run on their own. So Biden could be doing this now. Biden could use this speech to say, here is where we've come from. Here is where we, and not just do it in like a very data heavy, wonky, boring way, but to tell a story about how it's easier for us to start a business. It's easier for us to go on vacation, and we're doing it. We're taking road trips. We're spending time with our families now in a way we weren't 4 years ago. That I think I want to see the narrative. I want more than just the data. I want the narrative from Biden in this speech.
Has he ever done anything like this? Has he ever executed any sort of driven a narrative that has changed public opinion ever?
Well, I mean, that's a very high bar to aspire to, because public opinion
I think Reagan and Bill Clinton did that a lot, that kind of thing a lot.
But it took them time. It wasn't like they gave one speech and boom, everyone listened to them. I mean, they both had lags in the public perception of the economy and them getting credit for improvements. It took a lot of heavy labor. And so I think it's unfair to say Biden should give a speech. If it doesn't work, it means the whole speech was a failure. Like, you need a team. When you need a team effort, I would have ads with regular people across the country, people known in their communities, telling a similar story. So it's not just on Biden's shoulders, number one. But number two, I go back in history, Biden is actually pretty good. Now, he's not been the dry numbers guy historically. He's been the guy that sort of gets what it's like at the kitchen table. I know what it's like when your dad loses his job. I know what it's like to lose your dignity when you're unemployed. I know how important work is to keeping a family together. Like, he does know how to talk like that. I mean, is he at his A game communication wise? No, he is not. But I do think he intrinsically gets that it's about connecting with that voter and not just giving a policy brief.
Well, Bill, you may remember last year, Biden had a pretty good State of the Union, and I forget what it was, but he trapped Republicans into agreeing with him on something.
Right. You know, there was
Do you remember what that was?
There was catcalling about, you know, I think Biden said something about how many Republicans want to cut Social Security, and they all started booing, and he was like, oh, you want to save Social Security? Great, we're all on the same page. We solved it. America, Washington works again. And it was, you know, it wasn't just, I mean, to ad lib like that, ad lib, stay on message, take away an argument from the opposing party, like, that requires some cognitive skill. If you're literally out to lunch, you know, relying on a teleprompter to get through this trying ordeal, you can't do that. And you know, these moments don't get repeated on a news loop the way it does with Biden mistakes that Al-Sisi's from Egypt and not Mexico. So I am curious, because these Republicans, you know, used to be for a State of the Union, like, you were very careful how you reacted from the audience. But now, you know, the lunatics run the asylum. You can't control Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz or whoever. You don't know who's going to catcall. And I'm sure Biden is aware of that dynamic because he's been through it before. And will be hopefully somewhat prepared for the roller coaster ride that is now the State of the Union address.
Well, since we've talked about AI, I'm going to play a clip of Trump here in a second, Bill, good Lord willing, because we've talked about the age thing and communications. And I've been noticing lately progressives are trying to say that Donald Trump's losing it too. And they'll talk about how he confuses Nikki Haley with Nancy Pelosi. He confuses Joe Biden with Barack Obama. And I have to be honest with you, I thought that was BS because, you know, Trump seems energetic. Number two, he's always been a bit chaotic and discursive in his communications, just like Biden has. And number three, it just seems too convenient that Democrats have discovered that you can't fix Joe Biden, you can't replace Joe Biden. Therefore, they have to argue that Trump is just as bad. Trump has also lost a step. Trump is also has cognitive problems, you know, to sort of level the playing field and make the election about something else. But I have to say, I have been listening to clips of Donald Trump, and something's wrong. And so I was skeptical of this. I want to tell you, this is a very quick clip. But this one to me is the one that I find, I hate to say the funniest, but the most telling. Here we go.
We are a nation that just recently heard that Saudi Arabia and Russia will repeat.
I don't know what that was. And the greatest thing, Bill, about that clip is that that music in the background was at the rap. That's his like QAnon music, I think. So what do you make of that?
Well, I want to hold folks to the same standard here. You can't diagnose cognitive decline from afar. Just because you have a Rick Perry oops moment, for example, doesn't mean that like you no longer like have basic cognition. I do think it's fair to point out the kind of slips we keep harping about Biden having. Trump has similar slips. It's not really different to mix up people's names. That's not the same thing as cognitive decline. I mean, I'm sure you and I have like mixed up Iraq and Iran a billion times. It's the kind of that all of us do, and it doesn't get called out in the same way when you're 50 years old compared to when you're 80 years old.
No, it totally happens. Anybody who does speeches, talks on TV, video, will make those mistakes. The one that we just played of Trump seemed especially weird. But in any event, I was skeptical, and now I'm more of a believer. And so maybe Democrats and progressives can push this narrative as well.
I mean, how often do you give a speech where you speak off the cuff? Donald Trump, generally speaking, no pun intended, doesn't read from a script. You can tell when he does. It's always very stilted and obviously fake. He likes to go on stage with his people and just riff. And if you did that all the time, you would do weird things like that. You would get, and if you clipped it out and isolated it, you would look like something wasn't firing right. Which is why if you like some people make a big deal about they catch Biden with a note card. But of course, you can find photos of Trump having a note card. You should have note cards when you're the president of the United States because you want to make sure you're saying everything exactly right because the littlest mistake can cause a global crisis. That's why people use teleprompters and note cards.
Yeah, not just a political crisis. But an international, like you could start a war by saying the wrong thing.
Right, exactly. So all these things don't strike me as being true evidence of cognitive decline, but we should be judging these people on the same standards. And just because Trump might have more, of a caffeinated persona, it doesn't mean they don't make the same kind of slips.
All right. The next thing I have on my list, Bill, and possibly the last, we'll see, is Kyrsten Sinema. I guess I don't need to know at this point. I guess I've made it long enough that I won't really know how to pronounce the name. Kyrsten, too many of these similar names. But she has, I guess, announced that she's not going to seek re-election in Arizona. She was running as an independent. Let me play this clip of her, and then we'll talk about it.
Despite modernizing our infrastructure, ensuring clean water, delivering good jobs and safer communities, Americans still choose to retreat farther to their partisan corners. These solutions are considered failures, either because they're too much or not nearly enough. It's all or nothing. The outcome, less important than beating the other guy. The only political victories that matter these days are symbolic. Attacking your opponents on cable news or social media. Compromise is a dirty word. We've arrived at that crossroad, and we chose anger and division. I believe in my approach, but it's not what America wants right now.
I'm like, hey, she knows, like, she's come to terms with the realities of the world. So I give her credit for accurately diagnosing our political system and like hitting the road. I mean, maybe she could stay and fight and try to change it, but clearly that's not going to happen.
Well, I fundamentally disagree with your assessment of that video. And look, I've probably written the most nice stuff about Kyrsten Sinema than anybody in the universe. Okay. As far as I'm concerned, I think she is literally the most effective legislator currently in Congress right now. She deserves a large amount of credit for the agenda that Biden is going to run on. And it's not evident that someone else could have done it. Maybe, you know, maybe if could she be replaced and, you know, some could Chris Coons or Chris Murphy done the same things that she did? You know, maybe. But Chris Murphy himself, in a thread on X yesterday, said, you know, there's things that happen behind the scenes because Sinema willed it to happen, and you don't see it because it's behind the scenes. I think she, you know, 2 years ago, people would say it's literally impossible to pass things with 60 votes. You have to abolish the filibuster because these Republicans, they're just going to block whatever it is that Biden wants to do. There's no way it can't happen. Prove to me that they can actually happen. Well, she proved it. She proved it on infrastructure. She proved it on semiconductor manufacturing. She proved it on gun safety. She proved it on reforming the Electoral Vote Count Act. It may be if she managed to get the border compromise through, maybe she would have run. I don't know. I don't know if that was literally the determining factor at the end of the day. I think she proved the case. She proved the legislative case, but I think she made two significant political misjudgments. One is that she felt it was necessary to, if not be outright antagonistic to the progressive base in Arizona, definitely limit her contact with them to the point of non-existence. When you always have to do base maintenance if you're going to maintain a base plus swing coalition, and she did no base maintenance at all, which was a strategic error. And then commensurate with that.
Do you mean the sort of like care and feeding, or do you mean giving, like in terms of constituent outreach, or do you mean delivering legislatively for them?
No, I mean the former. I mean, look, she had a principled view that the filibuster should remain in place. It should not be abolished or suspended for things like the Voting Rights Act. That was obviously going to anger people in the base. A better politician would have spent the time to meet with people and explain yourself and communicate your theory of the case and get to a place where you can agree to disagree. So the anger level is diminished. She's not the only person who has reached across the aisle to make compromises. But, you know, Chris Murphy is getting kicked in the teeth the same way that Kyrsten Sinema is. Now, maybe he voted to abolish the filibuster. Other people have taken positions that the base doesn't like without the same intensity of backlash because they spent the time to stay in communication with people and to try to recognize that we're all on the same team here. So she kind of gave up on that. And
I wonder how much of that fits into her, like, she doesn't give any Fs. Rebel persona, like, I'm not gonna like waste time kissing someone's butt to get, like, I'm about getting things done, and like, if you don't like it, then tough. Like, that's I kind of admire that, to be honest. I mean, I think it's kind of cool, but apparently not effective when you want to be in the Senate,
right? I mean, what's very confounding about her is that she knows enough about coalitions to know how to navigate the legislative process, but she seems to be enough of an individualist, of an individual personality type, that she was reluctant to, you know, play the game in the, on the political side of the equation. You know, she had a theory of the case that you win Arizona elections in the middle, and I'm going to do that. And if you don't get it, then F you. Like, well, that's, you've missed the piece of the political puzzle there if that's where you land. I mean, this is a person who used to be in the Green Party, this person who likes doing things in her own way, and that literally only gets you so far. So that was sort of capped with this decision to say, I can't win a primary. I'm going to become an independent. Well, maybe you could have won that primary. You know, maybe if you did the base maintenance, there are enough Arizona voters that get that you do have to run up the middle to win elections here. That's not really there's this notion. This is a normie state. This is really a blue state. You can be a normie Democrat win the state. You know what? It's tilting red right now. There's very minimal evidence that like any old Democrat could win Arizona. This has been a long-standing Republican state. Katie Hobbs just barely beat Carrie Lake. I'm sure Mark Kelly beat Blake Masters, a certified lunatic. So it's not enough to just assume that it's that simple to win in Arizona. And maybe she could have communicated that better and won that primary. To win as an independent in any race, and I wrote about this, you know, a few months ago, in almost every circumstance, one of the major party candidates has to basically collapse for the independent candidate to scoop up that vote and win. There are a couple of examples where the Republican and the Democrat are sort of maintaining their bases and getting into the 30s, and the third party candidate gets in with 39%. You know, it's Jesse Ventura. And I think one of the main, not, I don't know if it was Angus King or a previous independent in Maine, the name escaped me. But that's a really hard needle to thread because you have literally very little margin for error. Upper 30s is the best you can do because your other candidates are getting into the low 30s. She was facing that kind of situation because Gallego was going to get Democratic base. And Lake's going to get Republican base. You got very little to work with after that. And I think she saw that writing on the wall and threw in the towel.
Do you think this makes it more likely that Democrats will take the seat and that Carrie Lake will not be able to join the United States Senate?
Yeah, I do. Partly because we're seeing Gallego run to the middle. He supported the border compromise that Sinema put together. We just learned this morning that he apparently didn't do a lot of fanfare, but he actually left the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Like, he understands there's a middle to win here. Maybe you can rationalize and say, well, he's not going to be as provocative and antagonistic about it. Maybe he's a better politician than Kyrsten Sinema is. But at the end of the day, he's going to have to do things that are not orthodox progressive to win in Arizona. And Carrie Lake has shown less capacity to do the same on the Republican side. Maybe she's starting to get the message late. She was desperately trying to win Meghan McCain's favor on X their day. And Meghan responded, all caps, no peace, bitch, because it's too late. You've said too many obnoxious things. We don't believe you. We know it's phony now. I think
her pivot is not happening. I mean, maybe she wanted to make peace with the McCains, but then she keeps saying and doing crazy stuff. I've seen three or four crazy things that she's done since the no peace bitch infamous tweet.
Sure. But what I don't know if we're going to gain is a legislator with the same skill as Sinema. And I think, and to go back to the beginning of this, what I hate about the video, that the withdrawal video, is she's put forth this notion that compromise is a political loser. Don't try if you want to keep your seat. I think that's a very, very bad, toxic message to put out. And it's self-serving. I was the noble legislator and I sacrificed myself to get these things done. But this is no way anyone can win election these days. So our system is doomed now. I think it is wrong. And I think it is bad to put that message out there in the universe.
It's definitely self-serving. I will say this, though. Look, I agree. You can't expect to do well at your job and automatically be rewarded for it without selling it, without doing the work to win election. And I think your analysis is correct that she didn't feel that she needed to kind of stoop to go out of her way to keep the progressives on board, or at least some of them, cobble together this coalition. But it is a fact that, as you've said, she was arguably the most effective legislator in Congress, and now she's done because she can't get elected. And I do think, and this is mostly a problem in the Republican Party, that there's this form of adverse selection, right? So like if you're Kathy McMorris Rogers, or if you're, who's the guy from Wisconsin who was the head of the China task force?
Gallagher.
Mike Gallagher, right?
Yeah.
That these kind of more serious Republicans are being pushed out of politics, pushed out of the Republican Party, and the worst get on top. It's a magnet for bad people and incompetent people and people who just want to be famous. And then the workhorses are kind of drummed out. And again, I think it's much more acute in the GOP, but this is, Bill, an example of that, that like just being a good legislator, compromising, getting stuff done ain't enough to keep your job.
Well, I think it's bad that, you know, Kevin McCarthy got shivved for working across the aisle and keeping the government open and avoiding a debt crisis. And again, did not have to be shivved. Democrats did not have to do what they did, and what they weren't forced to. There was a choice. And now you're seeing how difficult it is for Mike Johnson to keep the party
together. By the way, Bill, we didn't talk about this. Did you see? I saw like Democrats are now saying that they would defend Mike Johnson, that they would keep him. Did you see that?
Although it is conditional. It is conditional on him getting Ukraine aid through, which we'll have to see if he actually
Kevin McCarthy would have done that.
I Stephen Dennis, who writes for Bloomberg, point out that, you know, Sinema and McCarthy were friends. I think it is certainly plausible that a Speaker McCarthy gets that border deal through with the Ukraine aid. And we can't know, but certainly there was enough of a relationship there that Sinema would have more of an entryway into making that case to McCarthy than she does with Mike Johnson, who is much, much more beholden to the Matt Gaetzes who got him that seat. Now he's pushing his luck by keeping the government open now. He's making him a little bit mad, but he's still holding back on Ukraine aid and the border deal, which seems totally dead. So I think we have a downgrade here because people were not rewarded for taking risks and doing their due diligence to keep government functioning. Mitch McConnell is now out. And while, you know, Thune and Cornyn are more in the pragmatist camp than, say, Rick Scott, who might take a stab at this. We don't know yet. So maybe we're going to still get someone in that mold for a Senate Republican leader. But will they have the same capacity that Mitch McConnell had over the course of his many years, especially when McConnell wasn't able to get the last compromise done, the border compromise done?
I don't know if anyone uses the term adverse selection outside of the healthcare or like academic world, but, you know, I remember it from the Obamacare debate because it was essentially where the fear was that sick people would sign up and that healthy young people would opt out. And so I feel like that there's an analogy with our politics right now. Like healthy people are getting the hell out of Dodge and sick people are signing up and it's an adverse selection. Maybe there's another better term for it, but this trend.
No, it's genuinely concerning. And the only hope is that enough people like a Mike Johnson, people who had no background in working across the aisle, get in the seat and realize, oh, geez, I guess I really got to do the things that McCarthy did, because what else are we going to do? The whole place is going to fall apart if I don't do it. Will people step up when forced to step up? That's the question. And of course, a big question here is, does Biden get reelected? Because Biden is that guy. Biden is the guy who works across the aisle when he has to. And Donald Trump is not. So America has this choice very starkly laid before them for November. What kind of country do you want to have?
All right, my man. We're coming up on 40 minutes. It's a decent show. Anything I forgot? Final thoughts? Anything you want to plug?
Well, what do you want to see out of the State of the Union? I didn't ask you many questions today.
I'd like it to go quick. I'd like them to move it up to like maybe 7 p.m. I'd like maybe Dennis Miller or maybe an opening act, someone to inject a little humor, 15-minute warm-up. I'd like Biden to drink about a pot of coffee before he goes on.
Well, I don't know. That could go very awry, Matt.
Maybe take some uppers. I'm not, you know, apparently the Trump White House was awash in all sorts of drugs. Uppers, downers, speed, you know, whatever. So I think maybe there's, you know, Dr. Ronnie Jackson could maybe be tapped for a one-off to, you know, fulfill his duties that he once had. I'd like him to bring it. And what I would like is for Biden to show moral clarity on Israel. And that to me will be another thing I'm going to be watching. And you mentioned the heckling and the catcalling that could come from the right or the left. My guess is that Biden is now in a sort of mushy middle when it comes to Israel, not wanting to offend the Arab Americans of Michigan.
Well, let's be a little, it's not like everybody can speak about the Middle East so perfectly and not get into any kind of political, you know, quicksand. It's literally the most fraught issue that exists and has existed for decades. I don't know if you saw the whole Seth Meyers interview that he did. He was on Late Night with Seth Meyers. He called himself a Zionist in the interview. Now, of course, it was in the context of saying that Israel needed to, you know, change course. But it's certainly the kind of thing that could very easily be clipped out and used against him, you know, in some of these far left, you know, social media spaces. So I'm curious if I doubt he repeats that language in the State of the Union. But I do think, and this comes through in this new book by Alex Ward about his foreign policy, Biden's foreign policy record, which I have not read. I've only seen some excerpts. You know, but Biden's support for Israel runs pretty deep. And so I don't think he's going to in any way really abandon the country. But he's clearly fed up with Netanyahu, as he should be, because Netanyahu is doing lots of terrible things. And I think his North Star is the correct one, which is we need to end hostilities and get back towards a diplomatic track, but one that doesn't just simply allow Hamas to regroup and do October 7th all over again. You know, that's the part that's missing from some of the more simplistic ceasefire calls, that things have to change in Hamas's capacity for a ceasefire to hold. And that's obviously the sticky part of, you know, getting a deal done here.
I'd also like a shout out, possibly a Lenny Skutnik moment for Jason Kelsey, retiring from the Eagles. Maybe Taylor Swift performs an intermission at some point. So anyway, I've got thoughts. Maybe bring me in to do some coordinating. I'm available if they need to, you know, make it a little more entertaining, spice things up a little bit.
I'm sure Taylor Swift performing at the State of the Union would not cause any kind of conspiracy theories to generate.
Awesome. Well, let me plug a couple, something. Let me plug something. I interviewed the guys, the co-authors of White Rural Rage.
Bill. Oh, we just ran an excerpt of theirs in the Washington Monthly.
Yeah. And they were on Morning Joe last week and it aroused a lot of controversy on the right. And so I asked them about some of the pushback. We had a really good conversation. So you can check it out on our YouTube, youtube.com/Matt Lewis, or at the Matt Lewis and the News podcast on iTunes or wherever you get podcasts.
Check out the Washington Monthly, my Washington Monthly newsletter on Substack. My analysis of the recent polling was on Tuesday. I got to think of something for tomorrow's edition. So if you subscribe on Substack or through the WashingtonMonthly.com website, you can get that in your inbox 3 times a week.
You can watch us here on YouTube or listen to us on the podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. Bill Scher, always a pleasure.
I want to plug one more thing, Matt.
Yes, sir.
So in my capacity as vice president of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Library and Museum Standing Committee, March 28th, I am moderating a panel discussion in Northampton, but it will be accessible streaming, on the 100th anniversary of the Indian Citizenship Act, which Calvin Coolidge signed, which making all Native American citizens. Discussing the legacy of that piece of legislation with four experts in Native American history. So
that is cool.
That's going to be good stuff.
I love it. I love that you do that. Keep up the good work, and check us out back here in the DMZ next week. See you, Bill.
Okay. Take care.